rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is 2021-967, the State of Ohio versus Tysine Martin. For the appellant, Mr. Hackett.
Chief Justice O'Connor, counsel, may it please the court. 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. Your Honors, this case is about what types of claims may be brought to contest a mandatory bindover decision. Abuse of discretion claims require more than a mere error of law or judgment. Manifest weight claims, by contrast, bear directly on issues of witness credibility and the state's burden of persuasion. This court's decisions in Iacona and AJS make clear that mandatory bindover hearings are adversarial evidentiary hearings where juvenile judges hear live testimony, receive exhibits, and the testimony is subject to cross-examination. These are not one-way summary proceedings. Judges must assess the quality of the state's evidence on every single element of an offense, as well as any evidence that attacks probable cause. Iacona and AJS are therefore, of course, central to resolving this dispute. And so the answer in this case, I think, turns on two things. First, a very close reading of those decisions, but also, second, a careful parsing of the differences between abuse of discretion and man weight claims. Those differences show why manifest weight claims are needed for meaningful appellate review. And so at the outset, I think it is critical to first look at how these claims differ. Abuse of discretion and man weight claims are not coextensive, Your Honors. The purpose of manifest weight is to assess whether the state's burden of persuasion was met. These questions go to the probative force of the evidence presented. Under man weight, appellate courts have the authority and duty to assess the quality of the evidence presented, and that does not happen under abuse of discretion, which asks only whether a court's attitude was so unreasonable or arbitrary so as to constitute more than a mere error of law or judgment.
How does a appellate court assess credibility?
Just as it does under any other man weight standard. So it's an application here of the same man weight standard that's always applied.
And to give no deference to the trial court?
No, Your Honor, deference is due to the trial court, just as deference is due under an abuse of discretion standard. It's just that deference under man weight is given up to the point that the trial court clearly lost its way. So there is still deference due to a trial court's findings of fact, which include witness credibility. But it is, I would say, if you're looking on it on a spectrum, it's lesser than the deference that is due under abuse of discretion, which is most deferential.
What from the transcript do you look at to determine if, when, how the court lost its way?
Yes, Your Honor. So specifically the testimony of MG. And if I could back up a little bit, I think context is very important to understanding why this was a man weight issue here. It was because of this court's decision in Hanning, which requires, so Tyshawn was charged with a Category 2 offense, and the mandatory bindover was based on Category 2 with a firearm, which requires proof of operability. He also had an adult co-defendant, and so really the state had to show that Tyshawn's gun was operable. So boiled down, that issue really turned on the testimony of MG, who was not present at the scene. She instead viewed part of the incident via FaceTime video, which she said was crumbly. The phone also dropped on the ground halfway through. She testified on direct that she saw Tyshawn's gun fired, but then on cross-examination said that she actually had no idea whether that was true. And so, all else being equal, the testimony of MG needed to be weighed properly with an eye towards whether or not Tyshawn possessed an operable firearm. Adding to that was the fact that she testified that she heard that Tyshawn's gun was jammed. She heard him say that it was jammed and that it was not working. And so that's where the operability question came into play. Defense counsel in the juvenile court hearing at page 177 argued that the state had not proven operability beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, are you saying that the testimony that the gun jammed means it wasn't operable?
I think that put that the operability into issue.
Okay, but that doesn't preclude shots being fired and then it becomes inoperable by being jammed.
That's correct, but there were two other guns that were present at the scene.
Right.
Yes.
I understand that. If I read the trial court's comments at the close maybe of evidence, it says that they weren't sure whether there was, whether your client was even shooting.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yet the court found that there was sufficient evidence that he was, and the gun was operable, and bind him over.
That's correct, Your Honor, and the court did not provide any clearer of statements in writing as to the basis for its decision, nor did it resolve the operability question per se expressly. It didn't explain, you know, what it found to be persuasive.
But isn't that the point of ICONA, that the court doesn't have to resolve these disputes, that those are for the fact finder? That's almost a direct quote from ICONA.
I think it does have to resolve these disputes up to the point of probable cause. So, of
course, determination of the merits of the competing prosecution and defense theories, both of which were credible, ultimately was a matter for the fact finder trial. That's the holding of ICONA, right? That's the holding.
That's part of
the contrary to what you're saying.
No, it's not. So that's part of the holding, both of which are credible. What ICONA and AJS also say, and what they also confirm and emphasize, is that the juvenile court has the duty to evaluate the quality of the state's evidence. You couple that with Kent.
It says is it has the ability to evaluate the quality of the state's evidence to find whether or not it's credible, right? So once it finds the state has introduced credible evidence for each element of the offense, that's enough.
Well, we don't know
There's no weighing involved in finding whether there's credible evidence of each element of the offense, right?
We don't know from the record why the court found that the gun was operable. We don't know.
But why does that matter?
Because, again, the issue came down to the testimony of MG, who provided conflicting statements. And so this is a man weight issue because the juvenile court, in our assertion, did not properly weigh and assess MG's testimony.
But you've got ICONA directly on point saying that you're not supposed to judge the credibility of the witnesses, right? You're not supposed to weigh.
No, ICONA does say that the court must make credibility determinations and evaluate the
quality
of the state's
evidence. That the evidence was credible. That's what it says, right?
Correct.
If there's credible evidence, then that's sufficient under ICONA and under AJS. Now, I'm a little confused how a court would do what you want it to do, because there's no the rules of evidence don't apply, right, in the initial hearing.
That's actually an open question in Ohio. And if you look at the record in this case, there were evidentiary objections that were made all over the record. And so, again, this takes the form of
rules of evidence do not, I mean, I'm not sure that's an open question. There's numerous cases that have held that. Ohio
actually,
don't.
This court's bench card on transfer hearings specifically notes that it is an open question as to whether the rules of evidence apply. This court hasn't decided that. We were here a few weeks ago on another matter, actually, where this question was raised and discussed, but it has not been resolved, Your Honor.
Mr. Hackett, the trial court heard affirmative testimony from MG that he shot the gun, and then on cross-examination, she backtracked and said at some point the gun was jammed. Couldn't the trial court looking at the fact that some of that conflicting testimony came out on cross, couldn't the trial court, in the context of everything, just have made the credibility determination that MG was believable?
I think so, but I also think that, you know, that we should be able to present these very issues to a court of appeal. So the issue before this court is a narrow legal one as to whether these discussions, these arguments can even be made to a court of appeals. The court of appeals said manifest weight claims are not proper. And so while I think the questions are valid and while these discussions must be had, and of course there's always an uphill battle when you're presenting a manifest weight claim in any context because the standard is high, there is a particular legal question here that's been presented to the court as to whether, as a matter of law, manifest weight claims can be brought against the juvenile court's determination where these issues would be fleshed out.
Thank you. I understand. In this particular situation, is it because of the statement the judge made at the time of making the determination of probable cause about not being sure about whether the gun was operable that leads you to seek this legal clarification about manifest weight?
In part, yes, Your Honor. That, coupled with the conflicting statements made by MG, you know, her direct testimony versus her cross-examination, and again, the fact that there was an adult co-defendant who the state's witness, Detective Sperry, testified he had a gun and he shot too. And so this comes back again to Hanning in whether it was Tyshawn's gun that was fired and was operable or his adult co-defendants, because another particularly important fact is that there was only one fatal bullet. And so
it's a third gun as well.
That's correct, Your Honor, yes.
They don't know who had it or what kind of gun.
The testimony, if I recall correctly, was that a woman gave the victim, DN, the gun at the first gun at the outset of the fight, which was fired. It was dropped. Somebody else picked that up. Then, at that point, MG testified that she saw Tyshawn with a gun, and that was her direct examination testimony. So there wasn't a fray. There were a lot of questions about which gun was responsible, whether Tyshawn's gun was operable, and it was our intention to ask the Court of Appeals to look at these facts, to look at these conflicting testimonies, and to determine whether the juvenile court clearly lost its
way. Well, if you have the conflicting testimony, and under one version of the testimony that was given, the state establishes its burden. And under the other, I guess it would be on the cross-examination, the defense has established an equal to the state's position, opposite but equal, as Justice DeWine said. Then you serve that up to the trial court, and they figured it out, right?
Well, at the point of the trial court, Your Honor, it's that the bindover has already happened, and so litigants and juveniles are fighting at this stage to keep the child in the juvenile court, and this is ultimately, it results in a jurisdictional determination, which this court recently said in Smith. And so the decision made there is critically important, and so while, of course, Iacona and AJS say that juvenile courts do not determine ultimate merits, and they do not determine these issues beyond a reasonable doubt or guilt
or innocence.
It's
just probable cause, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, it is. And the standard, so the standard is proof beyond a mere suspicion. I don't know that that changes the analysis at all based on this court's holding in Eastley, which says, quote, because manifest weight refers to a greater amount of credible evidence and relates to persuasion, it does not matter that the burden of proof differs. In that case, it was between civil and criminal. Evidence must still exist on each element, which goes to sufficiency, and that evidence must satisfy the burden of persuasion, the same exact thing here. So while, of course, the burden of proof, probable cause, proof beyond a mere suspicion, is a lesser burden, no doubt, it is still a burden of persuasion nonetheless, and that's what implicates man weight. That, coupled with the prosecutor's duty to present credible evidence, as well as the juvenile court's duty, which AJS confirms, is to evaluate the quality of the evidence. And so, and again, going to Justice
DeWine's.
So you're
well into your rebuttal time, if that
Thank
matters
you,
to you.
I will reserve the remainder of my time unless there are further questions right now.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Oshaki.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, Cuyahoga County Assistant Prosecuting Attorney Greg Oshaki, on behalf of the appellee, the State of Ohio, I will be sharing 5 minutes of my time with Mr. Peterson from the Attorney General's office. I'd first like to address the questions raised by Justice Bruner and Justice O'Connor concerning the trial court's statement on page 181 of the transcript, where she says she doesn't know whether appellant was one of the ones that was shooting the gun. The very next sentence that the juvenile court judge says is, I want to watch the videos. And in those videos, you can see Tyshawn Martin, the only person wearing a backpack. He's seen going to the area in front of the school where the shell casings are found. After the shots are fired and you see everybody flee in one direction, you see Tyshawn and his group run around the other side of the school. He's holding a gun in his hand. With that, based and MG's testimony, there's probable cause to determine that Tyshawn Martin had a gun, had an operable firearm, and used it.
Why does that say operable? I mean, yeah, he had a gun.
Because he was found right where the shell casings were.
But wasn't the adult also within the vicinity of those shell casings?
There were two sets of shell casings that were found in front of the school, Your Honor. And I think...
When you say two sets?
There was a set of 40 caliber shell casings and set of 9 millimeter shell casings. So based on that, a reasonable inference is that, and a probable cause, there's more than a mere suspicion with Tyshawn running with a gun that he was one of the ones that had an operable firearm.
And then his gun jammed after he got off four shots.
Correct, Your Honor. And that's, once again, we're talking about alternate theories here, which the juvenile court is not allowed to weigh under this court's opinion in AJS. AJS sets forth the proper standard of review of a juvenile court's probable cause finding at a mandatory bindover, and that's incompatible with manifest weight. AJS says we defer to the trial court's credibility determinations because the trial court judge is in the best position to evaluate the witness's demeanor. The trial court was in the best position to evaluate MG's testimony on direct and on cross, her demeanor, her gestures, her voice inflections. Then the court reviews de novo the legal conclusion of whether the state presented sufficient evidence to demonstrate probable cause. Manifest weight challenge, the court acts as a 13th juror and weighs the evidence and the reasonable inferences, which is what AJS claims or states the juvenile court is not permitted to do. It's outside the limited scope of a probable cause hearing. At the probable cause hearing, it doesn't matter which side produces the greater amount of credible evidence. It doesn't matter if what the state presents is ultimately true. Once the state produces evidence that raises more than a mere suspicion, the analysis should stop. There should be no weighing of that evidence. In Iacona and in AJS, this court said that the appellate court can't weigh alternate theories. That's for the ultimate finder of fact.
Do you think that weighing evidence is akin to determining the quality of the evidence, or is there a difference?
The weighing of the evidence is, I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Do you think that the weighing of evidence is akin to judging the quality of the evidence, or is there a difference?
I think there's a difference. I mean, you can weigh the evidence. I mean, there could have been, for instance, KP was also supposed to testify at the hearing. She did not show up. She was going to testify that she watched the same video as MG. MG could have said, you know, his gun jammed. KP could have said, no, when I was watching the video, I saw him fire. If you're weighing the evidence, you're weighing those two statements, whereas the quality of the evidence is, does it meet probable cause? Does it meet more than a reasonable suspicion?
Thank you.
As far as credibility and the deference, in the JR case cited by appellant, it says that
the appellate court on reviewing a probable cause should defer to the juvenile court's factual findings and review for an abuse of discretion. And an abuse of discretion is not a manifest weight review. AJS also analogized it to the review of a suppression hearing, where the trial court assumes the role of the trier of fact, is best positioned to weigh the credibility and resolve the factual issues. Those are reviewed for clear error or abuse of discretion. Again, not equivalent to a manifest weight. If there are no further questions, I would just ask that this court rule that the juvenile court's probable cause determinations are not subject to a manifest weight challenge on appeal. Thank you.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. Manifest weight of the evidence review is inherently incompatible with the type of analysis that juvenile courts perform at the probable cause stage. That's because, as you've heard already, at the probable cause stage, the only question is whether the state presents enough evidence to raise more than a mere suspicion of guilt. Manifest weight does not ask that question. It asks the court to sit as a reviewing court, sit as a 13th juror, act as the ultimate fact finder, and disagree with the merits of the resolution of the competing theories of the case below. It's like applying manifest weight to probable cause is kind of like trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. They just ask different questions. And AJS points the way to the proper analysis. It cites Ornelas from the United States Supreme Court, which also reviewed a probable cause determination, and said that it's a hybrid question of law and fact. The questions of historical fact, you give deference to the originating court, the trial court, you review those for clear error. And then you look and you determine the legal significance of those facts de novo. And that's the appropriate type of review whenever you're dealing with a probable cause question. In response to my colleague's notice of additional authority, I took a quick look to see what lower courts had done in the context of abuse of discretion, and I found cases quite readily from the First District and from the 10th District that apply this standard to the probable cause determinations in other contexts. And admittedly, those are not cited in our brief, and so I don't feel comfortable citing them beyond saying that lower courts have no problem applying this bifurcated deference to the fact finder, de novo review of the law. And that's different from manifest weight of the evidence review, as one of my colleague's additional authorities, Scheider v. Kelly from the 7th District, explicitly noted. Manifest weight simply is not appropriate. It is for reviewing a final verdict, and it only applies when it matters whether the case has been proved beyond 50% or more. I know my colleague has cited Eastley v. Volkman as an example of an instance where you apply manifest weight even though there's a reduced burden. But in that case, it was still a more than 50%. How much weight was it, like whether the one side had greater weight on the other matters when the burden is 50% or more.
So can you apply abuse of discretion to how to judge the quality of the evidence?
I think an abuse of discretion standard is appropriate, and I think in Ohio, there's been some dispute about whether clear error and abuse of discretion are the same standard or different standard. The court doesn't need to get into that here, but I think it is appropriate to look at the quality of the evidence and ask whether the court could have reasonably reached its conclusion based on the quality of the evidence. That's an abuse of discretion standard, but the thumb is still on the scale in favor of the original fact finder. The reviewing court looks to see, is this a permissible view of the evidence? Is it, and if it is, that's not an abuse of discretion, it's not clear error, even if the reviewing court might have disagreed in the first instance. And so I think that's where the difference between clear error or abuse of discretion and manifest weight comes in. Clear error looks to see whether the quality could have supported that conclusion. Manifest weight calls for not a quite de novo review, but an independent weighing that abuse of discretion doesn't.
So in this situation, when the trial judge, the juvenile judge said, I really don't know if the gun was operable, and then relied on that as evidence to find probable cause, is that an abuse of discretion?
It isn't, Your Honor, because I think what the judge said there, you can't take that statement out of context, because as I think Mr. Ochaki said, if you look to page 181 and 182 of the hearing transcript, that was a preliminary statement, and the judge said, I don't know at this moment in time, but I want to look at all the evidence, I want to watch the video. And so that was a preliminary statement where the judge had not yet had an opportunity to review all of the evidence and really make a determination. And so it was sort of like, sitting here today, I don't know whether that's the case, but you know, the judge went back, reviewed all the evidence, and then made the probable cause finding. So I don't think that that preliminary statement has any bearing at all on the final resolution of the probable cause.
Thank you.
If there are no other questions, Your Honor, we would ask the court to affirm. Manifest weight is simply incompatible. Probable cause does not ask whether greater weight supports one theory or other. The court declined to accept a proposition of law that would have challenged that probable cause standard. So for these reasons, we would ask the court to affirm and hold that manifest weight has no place in a review of a juvenile court's probable cause finding.
Thank you. Mr. Hackett, you have a minute and a half left.
Thank you, Your Honors. My colleague's argument proves far too much. If AJS had applied a clear error standard, or if this court were to use it and adopt a clear error standard, we would not be here. That is why at the outset I started the discussion about the differences between abuse of discretion and manifest weight. Abuse of discretion is insufficient for these types of questions because it does not go to the evidentiary issues themselves. If there were a clear error standard applied to probable cause determinations and witness credibility determinations, which are factual questions, they are not discretionary questions, we would not be here. We wouldn't have an argument. The point and the problem and what this case boils down to is that if we are shoehorned into abuse of discretion claims only, we can never truly ask a court of appeals to decide whether or not a juvenile court at a probable cause hearing lost their way. And we can think of extreme examples of where that would become problematic. Secondly, Your Honors, the video that my colleagues referred to does not show the shooting itself. Inoperability in this particular case under these unique circumstances cannot be inferred because of Hanning.
Well, what I heard and in the briefs that they've provided as well, that it's circumstantial. You have your client positioned at one place, shootings taking place, you know, by the video, you hear everything. The gun jams, you hear, you know, that statement. And then your client running away with a gun.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, so where he was, there's two pile of shells, one from a 30 and one from a 9.
Correct.
So he either had a 30 or a 9.
No, Your Honor. So the state's detective, Detective Sperry, again, testified, and I apologize, I don't have the transcript page. The detective testified that different shell casings of these natures can come from the same gun.
Okay, so what are you saying?
That it is just as likely, or that there really is no evidence that does not equally point to the adult co-defendant, and because of Hanning, accomplice theories are impermissible.
All right, so the four, a 9mm ammunition and the four 30 caliber could have come from the same gun.
That was the state's expert's testimony.
And they would have been, what, loaded into a clip simultaneously?
Correct, or from the third gun as well. There was also another gun, and that was the victim's gun, and they were in very close proximity, close enough proximity that there was, you know, hand-to-hand, fist-to-fist fighting going on. So really, these shell casings were not so spread out that, you know, that you could tell that one came from this person, absolutely, one came from this person, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.